thank you very much, Chuck, and thank all of you. There is a variation on that, which I didn't invent, and I, in fact, used at the national meeting in April. I heard somebody say at a seminar we were having earlier this year that a lot of conservatives have, in fact, changed their views about big government, that we came here thinking that it was a cesspool, and now it feels more like a hot tub. Same idea, I guess, basically. I would like to say I'm not going to talk very much about the election. I will mention it briefly, but there are some ongoing issues that are still out there apart from the election, and it's kind of a pleasure not to talk about the election as such. And I'm reminded a bit of my grandmother's comment once when I asked her why she never voted, and she said, "It only encourages them." I do have a few political bulletins to impart before we get to the subject matter here. One, something that is going to happen in an effort to resuscitate the sagging fortunes of the Democratic Party Monday morning. Tim O'Neill and Teddy Kennedy are issuing a joint manifesto of compassion in which they will state that this nation cannot rest so long as 50% of the population is below the median. They've got a couple of other items here. Oh, okay, one thing. In reading the election tea leaves, and I want to focus most on the foreign policy and defense aspects, but there are a lot of these columnists and soothsayers who are trying to interpret away the mandate of the election. And I think, as Dave Gergen said, the Republicans won the election but are losing the interpretation. And I don't think we should let that happen. It seems to me that there are two clear issues that were salient in this campaign, and we shouldn't let them go. One is on the domestic front, that I think the public has made it very clear that they want at least two Supreme Court justices chosen by Jerry Falwell. And in the exit polling that was done for my column, some respondents said three or more, but we dismissed that. And on the foreign policy front, I think it is very clear that the American public is very enthusiastic about the illegal war in Nicaragua, and with or without assassination handbook. Finally, and one thing just before getting into this, I just heard the jokes over in the next room here. Some people wonder what my qualifications are to speak on this subject, which is a very good question. I would point out, and I think I did mention this also at the national meeting, that I am the chairman of the National Committee for the Prevention of Nuclear Peace. And they're vacuuming the rug out of here. Give me a break. Right. Okay. The motto of our committee is, since we already have enough bombs and missiles to blow up the world 10 times over, a few more couldn't hurt anything. Thank you very much. You are too kind. Now, the question is the global challenge, and I'm not going to talk about that. I am going to talk about that. That's the surprise. I'm going to talk about the topic of this panel. The global challenge could be interpreted in a number of ways, I suppose. But to me, it means basically the challenge that is presented to our society by the Soviet Union, the international communist enterprise, and what we ought to do about that. And one of the things, there's sort of a cottage industry, or more than that, in this city and in various universities and think tanks, is the art of Kremlinology, in which people look for little gestures, manifestations or theta waves or something coming out of the Soviet Union, which suggests some kind of change in the power configuration there, or their attitudes toward us, or their readiness to negotiate. It's not like this thing that Chernenko, this willingness to talk about something. And a lot of time is spent on reading those tea leaves and tracking those fluctuations. And it seems to me that basically, while that is, it's not, I guess, totally irrelevant, it is by and large a waste of time. And worse than that, it is essentially a distraction and misdirection of our energies and of our mental faculties. Because the one thing which is apparent in the history of our dealings with the Soviets and their various agents in different parts of the world is not the things that change all the time, it's the things that are the same all the time. The constants in our relationship with the Soviets are what are important. And there is no historical evidence, to my knowledge, that in the fundamental attitude of the Soviets toward us, their objectives with respect to our society in the long run, their objectives with respect to other societies in the short run, their techniques of negotiating and their willingness to expand their empire, their willingness to misrepresent, mislead, violate agreements, that any of that has ever changed. And I've never seen any of these interpretations or analyses that suggest that there is any such evidence. It's all just this kind of impressionistic effort to read our wishes into certain peripheral phenomena in the hope that this rather obdurate and menacing challenge will somehow go away, or at least attenuate and not be quite so difficult to deal with. And it seems to me the fundamental constant that must be affirmed, the fundamental point that any rational being has to recognize, is that Soviet Union does mean us ill, has never relented in its objective of global conquest over the long term, has never ceased agitating for the expansion of its empire, has never stopped exporting the revolution except when it was prevented from doing so by force, and that our calculations, absent impressive countervailing evidence, must be based on that simple recognition. Unfortunately, that isn't the case in the Congress of the United States. Certainly is not in the many of the media that interpret these events, and is not always the case even within the Reagan administration, something I shall refer to momentarily. In that context, absent that countervailing evidence, it seems to me that this administration, this government, and this country have very, very serious problems to deal with indeed in the matter of confronting the Soviet Union and its agents. And I'm just going to discuss, obviously, this is a global matter. One could talk about events in the Far East. One could talk about the Middle East. One could talk about European problems of the peace movement over there and all of that. But I'm going to talk and pick the three things which I believe to be paramount in the short term and also with long-term implications for this administration right now and when it renews its activities after the first of the year in the second administration. Most obviously, what is immediate in the headlines and in the proximity to our own borders is the situation in Central America. Unfortunately, the way that this has been reported and discussed is very misleading in a number of different ways. For example, we have been led to believe for the last year and more, for the last couple of years, that the locus of difficulty in Central America was El Salvador, and that if we could have free elections in El Salvador and establish a democratic government there, and that if we could have a continuation of the so-called land reform and get correction of human rights abuses. And these are the three statutory requirements for that must be certified by the president for continued military aid to El Salvador, that this would be a dramatic step towards solving the problem in El Salvador and derivatively in Central America. Well, there is certainly every need to try to aid El Salvador in its battle against the communist guerrillas, and I would point out that these are self-described communists. They are not freedom fighters or exponents of peasant justice. They are communists, and so designated in their own histories and literature. And the government needs aid against their incursions, and we certainly need to be concerned about human rights there and everywhere else, I would affirm. Although I have a different attitude toward the so-called land reform, but we can pass over that for the moment. Despite all of that, the fact remains that the problem in Central America, and indeed the problem in El Salvador, is not El Salvador. The problem in Central America is Nicaragua. There would be no successful or even moderately successful guerrilla activity in El Salvador if it were not for the Marxist regime in Nicaragua. The command and control and supply base for the guerrilla movement in El Salvador is in Managua. That is where the guerrilla leaders are situated. That's where they make their plans. It's also where they, from time to time, murder each other and engage in various internecine struggles. And it is also where the supply of arms from the Soviet bloc in Cuba is funneled in to reach El Salvador and to sustain that revolution. The perception that the problem is in Nicaragua has only recently come to the forefront, and I think that is a good development in some ways, although the way in which it is being discussed is a bit distracting. For example, the concentration recently on whether or not the Soviet ship that was tracked around the Cape up on the Pacific side of Nicaragua was containing MiGs, and the focus on whether or not MiGs were being brought into Nicaragua became the major preoccupation of the media, to a large extent of the Reagan administration and so on. Well, it certainly would be a very serious matter if MiGs or other high-performance aircraft were introduced into Nicaragua, but the fact that that ship apparently didn't contain MiGs and contained only helicopter gunships, apparently, really does not change the fundamental nature of the problem in Nicaragua. Nicaragua is an armed bastion of the communist world. There are 48,000 members of the regular army of Nicaragua, and at the height, for purposes of comparison, at the height of the revolutionary combat when Somoza was in charge of Nicaragua and the Sandinistas were fighting him, he had 14,000 members of his National Guard, less than a third of the regular army of Nicaragua today, and they have as many reserves. They have literally hundreds and in some cases thousands of weapons that have been brought in there, including tanks, about 70 tanks. They have all kinds of armored personnel carriers. They have SAM missiles. They have modified, and this has led to this speculation about the MiG, their airstrips to accommodate high-performance aircraft. They have about 3,000 Cuban military advisors there, and so on. It is very clear that this is a beachhead of the Soviet-Cuban communist program on the mainland of the Americas. As such, it is by far the most audacious of the various probes that the communists have conducted to test our resolve and to penetrate our security defenses and the threat that could be posed to the Panama Canal and to shipping in the Gulf and the Caribbean and to the southeastern and southwestern United States from MiGs or other weapons based in Nicaragua could be very severe indeed. It seems to me that what must be done with respect to this is pretty clear. This is a case in which the administration and the United States have an opportunity to do something which, with the exception of Grenada, which was very small, of course, and rather marginal to the central struggle here. There is a real chance in Nicaragua to do something that, except for Grenada, really hasn't been done in the Cold War struggle to date, and that is to roll back the Iron Curtain, in this case, I guess, the sugar cane or coffee curtain, and to divest the Soviets of this base and the Cubans of this space on the mainland of the Americas. This opportunity exists because of the very real resentment of the Nicaraguan people against this regime, because of the persecution of the church, which is occurring in Nicaragua, because most immediately of the resistance, the armed resistance being posed by the so-called Contras, the anti-communist freedom fighters, most of whom are not Somocistas, as has been alleged, but were actually votaries of or supporters of the Sandinistas to begin with, but became disenchanted and went into opposition. If aid could be supplied in sufficient quantities, it seems very likely that at a minimum the Contras would be able to pin down much of the armed force of the Nicaraguan military, and at the maximum, and I don't see any reason why we should not aspire to this maximum, actually topple that government and reverse this advance by the Soviets and the Cubans. The difficulty is that the Congress has repeatedly voted to restrict and finally to cut off the aid that has been extended to the Contras, causing the Reagan administration to have to try by a variety of circumventions to get that aid to these people. And that has been, in terms of public opinion, a losing struggle in the Congress. It seems to me that the administration must, at this point, very soon, draw that line and take the case about what is happening to Nicaragua. And there's a very, I might say, a very good outreach program in the White House that supplies a lot of this information. But it needs to be taken in a very full-scale way by the president and by all the organs of opinion that are at his disposal to the American people. And the line must be drawn with the Chris Dodds and the Steve Solarses and the Mike Barneses and the other people that are trying to insulate the Sandinistas from any kind of resistance. And put it just that plainly, that if, in fact, Central America is turned into a communist isthmus, which there is some likelihood of occurring, it will be because of these people and the policies they're pursuing, and that if the American public does not want that outcome, it should support aid to the Contras, and the vote, they should be forced to vote up or down on that basis. But you cannot win this kind of battle where the rhetorical initiative remains with the Chris Dodds and the Solarses and the Mike Barneses, and the administration sort of backpedaling, saying, well, we're really not trying to, you know, we're just trying to work around the edges here and help these people. You've got to confront the issue head on. Okay, that is one example, it seems to me, of a kind of strategy which should be pursued globally. And there are two other opportunities for pursuing such a strategy in the world today that come immediately to mind. One is in Afghanistan, where you have a resistance movement that is very, very strong in terms of its support by the people of that country, which has, by all accounts, denied the Soviets the freedom of the countryside. They're bottled up in Kabul and other cities. And this resistance movement has great prospects of repulsing the Soviet effort to conquer Afghanistan if it gets sufficient aid. Again, however, the issue has not been confronted directly. And this is an issue, I might add, where people such as Paul Tsongas and other liberals in the Congress have come forward in favor of a program of aiding the freedom fighters. And I think that the same logic that is applied there should be applied in Central America and vice versa. And people should be made to see that this is an opportunity to reverse the momentum of the Cold War. The third example, I won't dwell on this, is Angola, where you have a resistance movement headed by Jonas Savimbi, which, again, without very much assistance from us at all. In fact, there's legislation on the books written by Dick Clark, not the disc jockey, but the former senator, which prevents, and the disc jockey is a much better human being, I might add, the United States is prevented from giving aid to Savimbi by that legislation. That legislation must be changed, and again, the line must be drawn, and the issue must be projected to the American people. Okay, that's in the realm of struggles in the third world. Other things could be added to that, but I won't dwell on that. Let me just cite a couple of other things that I think need to be addressed in a similar assertive fashion by this administration as it revs up for its second term. there's endless talk. There was endless talk in this campaign about arms control, about the willingness of the Reagan administration to sit down and talk with the Soviets, and no major arms control agreement, and so forth and so on. And to this, President Reagan responds, well, you know, we're trying to get an arms control agreement. And the Soviets have been intransigent. They broke off the walk in the woods thing and so on. The premise of such discussion, both in the political debate and in the media, is that arms control is a good thing. It is sort of a given that to have an arms control agreement with the Soviets is good, and the absence of an arms control agreement is bad. This is rather like the fundamental premise itself, the idea that the Soviets, there's something there, there's some change, and we can read these tea leaves, and we can look for some hopeful signs of what's going on. There is not a scintilla of evidence in the record that the Soviets abide by arms control agreements. There is a great deal of evidence, and Mr. Silverman, who is going to be up next, was a member of the General Advisory Committee for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which put together a very fine report on this subject, which went through the history of Soviet compliance or non-compliance with arms control and other agreements. And there is a great deal of evidence that they don't abide by these agreements. There is evidence that they're violating the SALT I agreement, particularly the SALT I ABM treaty, which is the incarnation, really, of the predominant philosophy of disarmament in this country. There is evidence they're violating the SALT II treaty, even though it's unratified. We are abiding by the terms of SALT II. There is, in short, a cornucopia of empirical data suggesting that an arms control agreement with the Soviets not only isn't worth very much, but that it is affirmatively harmful, because in the illusion that these agreements are in fact going to bring about changes in Soviet behavior, we change our behavior. We abide by the arms control agreements. We restrain ourselves in the deployment of missiles. We have fewer missiles in our arsenal today than when Ronald Reagan came into office, the retirement of old missiles and the lack of adding new ones. As Cap Weinberger pointed out the other night, we've been debating the MX missile, another generation of missiles to replace the Minuteman, for 11 years. And I'm sure we'll have a series of votes on it in this Congress as well. And we have stalled out, really, on the improvement of our arsenal while the Soviets have built their arsenal. So it isn't just that these things don't accomplish very much. They accomplish things that are very bad. They freeze our behavior. They do not freeze the behavior of the Soviets. And let me just comment a bit on the strategy that is being pursued here, because one of the most important things that came out of this campaign, which came out of the debate, the second debate, October 21st, in President Reagan's first administration, was the so-called Star Wars, or Strategic Defense Initiative. That is a very hopeful, in my view, a decisively important initiative, and it can be understood only in a context of what our preceding strategy has been. I've heard a lot of talk. I heard Paul Warnke talk about this. I heard Harold Brown the other night talk about it, and I've read a lot of stuff about how, gee, it would be great to have these defenses against Soviet or other missiles, if only were technically feasible. And the posture being suggested by that is that the disarmament people like the idea, but they just can't accomplish it technically, so forget about it. It's not going to happen. Whether or not this is technically feasible, and there's certainly an argument about that at some levels of this activity, do not be deceived into thinking that the liberal defense intellectuals and disarmament lobby are opposed to strategic defenses of the type Ronald Reagan is talking about because they believe they are technically unfeasible. What they really fear is that they might be technically feasible. And in fact, in 1960, Dr. Jerome Wiesner, who is the premier guru of this opposition to anti-missile defenses, said that if it appears that such defenses would be feasible, then it is imperative that disarmament agreements control and prevent the development and deployment because they would be destabilizing. And what this means in the terms of the ruling strategy is that It is a bad thing, and I wish President Reagan had talked a little more about this in that debate, not because he needed it to win the election, but because he needs it to win this initiative. The ruling strategy is that it is a good thing for the civilian population of the United States to be left exposed to nuclear attack by the Soviets, which means no anti-missile defenses, which also means the degrading of our air interceptor force. That's 90% of our air interceptors have been phased out. The degrading of our distant early warning system, radar system for intercepting airplanes. No civil defense. It means all of those things because not having any protection for our civilian population reassures the Soviets that we obviously can't be planning a war because if we attack them, our population will be turned into a grease spot, and we wouldn't do that. The only deterrent we have against their attack is the ability to kill their population. This is part of the theory, and they're supposed to follow this logic and not have any missile defenses either, not have any civil defense, and assume the same posture that we have assumed, that the only deterrent is in our offensive strategic missiles. This doctrine is called mutual assured destruction, or MAD. It is a policy of planned defenselessness for our civilian population, which has also resulted in putting our deterrent at hazard because we can't protect that very well either, which is what the MX is about. The problem with this, quite apart from the clinical lunacy that is manifest, is that the Soviets have never played by these rules. And most of the violations that are really disturbing to people in this country, again, I will yield to my colleague, he knows more about this than I, but are these ABM violations, this phased array radar and testing missiles in an ABM mode and all of these things that they're not supposed to do under the ABM treaty, apparently they have done, and there's very little evidence they've ever accepted this theory to begin with, which means they are developing the defenses that could prevent us from wiping out their population, but we don't have the defenses to prevent them from wiping out our population. There are other substantive things I've talked about. I've talked long enough. Let me just say this. I mentioned that the difficulty that the president has in the Congress, the difficulty of the media, both of which are very serious problems indeed. He does have, and this has been alluded to in other contexts, a problem within his own administration. He has a problem in the State Department, which is manned almost from stem to stern and from one side to the other with career officials who are not sympathetic to his program, who fight his program at every step of the way, and who are not about to undertake the kind of initiatives on these issues that are imperative if he is to prevail in making the defenses of the United States more secure and in taking the offensive against the international communist enterprise. Thank you.